Chapter 16. Rose. January 1980. Daphne moved in with us on New Year's Day. She turned up on the doorstep just after lunch, her blonde hair in a French-style plait, shivering in her thin coat, armed with just a rucksack and the clothes on her back. I often wondered, in the days and weeks that followed, why a woman who, I assumed, was in her mid to late 30s, had no other worldly possessions. It seemed to me she had left her last location in a hurry. Was it rash of me to invite a stranger into our home? I didn't think so. Not then, anyway. Then she was nothing more to me than a lodger, someone to pay rent so that I had another source of income, rather than squandering the last of my parents' inheritance. From her demeanour on Christmas Eve, I sensed she was as desperate as I was to hide away. And I was willing to bet my life on it that it was for similar reasons, running from a man. That first evening was a little awkward. I showed her around the cottage and to her room so she could dump her stuff. I saw the cottage through her eyes, the unvarnished floorboards that I still hadn't got around to carpeting, except in your bedroom, pink, like you wanted. The tatty kitchen with the brown tiles, the fireplaces instead of radiators, the old Rayburn range that was always on, and where I boiled water in a cast iron kettle. "What do you use this for?" asked Daphne, pointing to the door on the left as we descended the stairs. "Nothing at the moment," I said, leading her into the empty room with the brown and yellow patterned wallpaper left from the last owner. "It's not a very big room. I think it was probably a front parlour or something." She frowned. "I suppose you could use it as a dining room." "True, but we have the table in the kitchen. Or a playroom for Lolly. She usually plays by me in the front room, or up in her bedroom. But..." I hesitated, glancing at her. "You're welcome to use it, for whatever you want." Her face brightened, and she turned to me, her eyes widening. "Really? That would be great. Although..." Her face fell. "I don't have my sewing machine anymore." "You sew?" "I made my own clothes before." She blushed. "Anyway, I'll save up and buy another." I wondered if she'd made the patched green coat she was wearing. It certainly had a homemade look about it. "You might be able to get one second hand. I can ask around." "Thank you." She lifted her eyes to mine and held my gaze longer than was comfortable. Her lashes were tinted with blue mascara, a fleck of which had landed on her pale cheekbone. She had a very small black dot on her iris that looked like a beauty spot. I lowered my gaze first. "Right, well, I better see to Lolly," I said, turning around and going back upstairs. Later, after I tucked you up in your little iron-framed bed, Daphne and I sat side by side on the brown corduroy sofa, like a nervous couple on a first date. She was still wearing her coat and a pair of navy platform boots that looked like the toes had been coloured with pen under her flared jeans. I poured us both a glass of baby sham that Joel, the landlord of the Stag and Pheasant, had given me for Christmas. We sat and watched the flames and logs spit and crackle in the open fire. The smell of smouldering wood and firelighter fuel was heavy and intoxicating. The radio was on, and Blondie's Heart of Glass was playing in the background. I could see Daphne taking in the modest living room with the pink and blue flowered wallpaper I put up myself when we first moved in, and the fringed floor lamp in the corner that clashed. "I hope it's not too basic for you," I said to her. "At least we have an indoor bathroom. The last owners put it in." Daphne smiled enigmatically, casting her eyes around the room. "I've lived in worse," she said, and I tried not to feel offended. I'd made it as homely as I could for you. It was cheap. I smiled and shrugged, trying to look nonchalant and not like I was secretly proud of owning my home. Something nobody else could ever take away. My security. I didn't want to spend all the money I had on a property. I'd ignored the estate agent's warning about the ridges on a thatch roof having to be replaced every 10 years. It seemed so far away. I might have moved by then. She raised one of her thin, penciled eyebrows. It must be hard being a single parent. I nodded. Better than the alternative, I thought. Although, I didn't say that. Did your husband leave you this cottage? I hesitated. She thought I was a widow. What to tell her without giving anything away? You have to understand, Lolly, that I had always been so honest before, telling people everything, the cost of a new top, how much I earned, who I was going out with, whether or not they actually wanted to know. But I'd learnt the hard way to keep my mouth shut. I nodded and sipped my drink. How long ago did your husband die? When I was pregnant, I replied. I felt terrible for lying. How awful, she said, playing with the stem of her glass. She glanced at my hand, noting the absence of a wedding ring. I didn't want to admit there had never been a ring. Have you ever been married? I asked her instead. She shuddered. God, no, I'm never getting married. Really? I don't understand why anyone would want to tie themselves down to a man. Was it because she'd also been treated badly? Or had I got her wrong? Maybe she was just a bit of a free spirit, or a hippie. Maybe she believed in free love. She was attractive, with large hooded eyes, an elfin face and long, dyed blonde hair, the brown roots visible. I was sure she'd have no shortage of male interest. I'd always thought of myself as reasonably attractive, not stunning or a head-turner or anything like that, but natural and threatening. I could see that Daphne was more striking. I cleared my throat. I know this is a bit delicate, and we probably should have talked about this before you moved in, but with Lolly and everything, I think it's better there are no... How could I put this tactfully? Overnight visitors. She stared at me for a few moments, then let out a loud laugh. Oh, Rose, look at you. You've gone red. I promise I'm not going to be entertaining men in the bedroom. Honestly, men are the furthest thing from my mind. I sip my drink in relief. Do you mind if I smoke? I shook my head. I try not to smoke around Lolly, if that's okay. She looked a little surprised, but shrugged. That's fine. I'll go into the back garden. She placed her drink on the side table and stood up. I followed her into the kitchen and through the back door. She stood on the patio outside, shivering in her ribbed polo neck and thin coat. And I felt so guilty that I told her we could stand in the doorway. She handed me a roll-up. We stood in silence, puffing on our cigarettes, as a fine layer of ice coated the paving slabs in front of us. Thank you, she said eventually, for agreeing to rent me a room. I think this will work out well. I didn't know if it was the alcohol or the nicotine or a combination of both, but I suddenly felt confident that she was right. We both wanted the same thing, I could already tell. Peace and quiet. Anonymity. Standing there with her on that first day of a new year, a new decade, I never dreamed, in a million years, that her baggage, her past, would put us in danger. Chapter 17. Lorna. The next morning, Lorna offers to take Snowy for a walk to give Safi some space. Even though it's been only 4 days, Lorna can tell by her daughter's slightly harangued expression that she is getting under her feet. The more Lorna tries to be helpful around the house, the more Safi looks like she's sucking a sour boiled sweet. She thought, hoped, that this gruesome discovery would bring them closer together. She knows it's selfish, but now Safi is pregnant, she fears the gap will widen even further between them. She realizes she made mistakes when Safi was growing up. Lorna had been happy for her mother to take over. She'd shipped Safi off every summer so that she could have a break, act like a teenager, and then the young woman she'd been at the time, going to clubs and pubs, and when she and Ewan finally split up, hooking up with unsuitable men. And now Safi finally needs her, really needs her, even if she doesn't yet know it. She leaves Safi in her depressing little study, hunched over her computer, and steps outside into the sunshine. She takes deep breaths, then coughs as the smell of the countryside hits the back of her throat. The skies are cloudless. She's wearing a light top with her jeans and sandals. She probably should have brought flatter shoes. Heels aren't the best for the slopes and inclines of Beggar's Nook. As she treads over the gravel driveway with Snowy, she notices a large van parked up. A young, well-dressed woman in a purple suit and dark hair that doesn't move in the breeze is talking to camera on the pavement. "This might look like just another idyllic Cotswold cottage," she is saying into a microphone in a sepulchral tone. "But looks are deceiving. Two bodies have been found here at Skelton Place." She turns to indicate the cottage, and Lorna freezes, not sure whether to keep walking or stay still. The journalist's face lights up when she sees her. "And here is one of the owners now." She moves towards Lorna. "It must have been a shock to discover the bodies," she says, thrusting the microphone into Lorna's face. Lorna bristles. "This isn't my house." "Oh." The reporter looks thrown, and then professionalism kicks in. "I gather you're not Saffron Cutler." "No, I'm not." "I understand this cottage used to belong to Saffron's grandmother. Is that correct?" "No comment," says Lorna. "Now, if you'll excuse me."
"Cut!"
shouts the cameraman. He's standing in the road and an irate driver beeps for him to move. He strides to the pavement, but doesn't apologize or acknowledge the driver. The reporter looks daggers at him before fastening her gaze back on Lorna. "It would be great if we could interview you for our news segment. Heliana Phillips, pleased to meet you." She extends a hand, but Lorna doesn't take it.
"There's no story here," snaps Lorna. "We know nothing about the bodies. It happened years before my daughter lived here."
Heliana pushes a lock of her sleek hair behind her ear. "Well," she says, in a soothing voice that Lorna suspects is put on to cajole. "I think this is a very interesting story. It's not every day that two bodies are discovered now, is it? Are you sure there aren't any more?"
"Quite sure," says Lorna, gently pulling Snowy to his feet and moving away.
She notices a few of the elderly ladies who live across the road have clustered together on the pavement and are watching the scene with disapproving expressions, arms folded across their chests. Lorna understands that this Heliana and the other reporters are just doing their job. She's used to it,
after all, once living with Ewan. But she wishes they'd bugger off, particularly for Safi's sake. She notices how her daughter hides away when they're outside, like a prisoner in her own home. Lorna stalks off down the hill in her unsuitable shoes, ignoring Heliana's calls. Her heart is beating fast, but she doesn't slow until she reaches the stag and pheasant at the bottom of the slope. Then she stops to catch her breath, before continuing through the village square. It opens up like a scene from a pop-up children's book, and as she passes the market cross and the quaint little church, she is besieged by that diaphanous memory again. It floats frustratingly out of reach. The market cross is so familiar to her that she finds herself heading there. She sits on one of the cold steps, surveying the rest of the square. And it hits her. A memory, struggling to solidify in her mind. She remembers walking through this square, flanked by two women, each holding one of her hands, her mother, and someone else. Someone faceless. The woman in the photograph, perhaps. It's more of a feeling than a memory, and it instantly makes her feel melancholy. A bit like grief. What is it about this place? She wonders, getting to her feet. When she's here, she feels enveloped in a sadness she can't explain. As if a cold mist has descended over her, covering her like a veil. This won't do, she thinks. She needs to snap out of it, to remember why she's here. She mentally ticks off all the things she wants to buy. Ingredients to make a traditional Spanish paella for Safi and Tom tonight. She heads over the little bridge to the shop at the end of a row, tying Snowy to a post. She's getting used to him now. She'd even go as far as saying she feels some affection for him. The corner shop doesn't have all the ingredients she needs, so she has to improvise. As she walks around the narrow aisles, she notices a few stares from other customers. She ignores it. She's used to being stared at. She pays, and then, with Snowy, ambles to the little cafe on the corner, the Beggar's Bowl. The cafe allows dogs, so she takes Snowy inside. It's cramped, with just enough room for two round tables towards the back. There is an elderly man with a shock of white hair in front of her, talking to the young guy who's serving behind the counter, and she just catches the tail end of his conversation.
Such a quiet place, but now there's journalists everywhere, and coppers. One came to my door last night asking questions. It was dinner time. Who comes knocking at dinner time, I ask you? This is what happens when youngsters come in and overdevelop their houses.
He falters when he notices Lorna. He raises his white, craggy eyebrows at her, but doesn't continue his tirade. Lorna's tempted to tell him not to stop on her account, but she doesn't want to make things worse for Safi. She's the one who's got to live with these villagers, after all. The man takes his cup from the guy behind the counter, nods at her without smiling, and leaves the cafe.
What can I get you?
Asks the young guy. If he knows who she is, he doesn't let on, and she's grateful. She orders a latte and makes small talk while he's preparing it. She learns that his name is Seth. He grew up in this village. His aunt used to own the cafe, and that he's off to do a degree in engineering at Nottingham in October. She's smiling to herself as she leaves with her precious latte. He's the first friendly person in the village she's encountered since she arrived. As she slows down to sip her coffee, she hears someone clearing their throat at her shoulder. She turns to see a man in his late 50s, wearing a checked shirt and jeans. Short, greying hair and narrow eyes that seem to be assessing her for longer than is polite. She stops walking, and Snowy plunks himself at her feet.
Hi, he says, smiling pleasantly. You live at 9 Skelton Place, don't you?
He has a northern accent, and there is something about his posture and tone that screams ex-military.
No, I'm just visiting, she replies. I'm not from around here either,
he says, surprising her.
Oh, right.
Then it occurs to her. Are you a journalist? He looks taken aback.
Oh, no. No, I'm just visiting too. The name's Glenn.
He holds out a hand, and she feels it would be impolite to refuse to shake it.
I'm Lorna.
His handshake is firm.
I heard about the bodies up at Skelton Place. Everybody in the village is talking about it.
Yes, I can imagine. He grins at her, still holding her hand. She wonders if he's trying to chat her up. He must be a good 15 years older than her, at least. She supposes he's quite handsome, in an older man kind of way. Although there is a hardness to his face. She retracts her hand. Anyway, she says, I need to get back. Nice to meet you, Glenn.
Nice to meet you too, he says.
But he stays where he is. As she walks away, she's sure she hears him call out,
Say hello to Rose.
But when she turns, he's heading towards the woods. She frowns at his retreating back, wondering if she should run after him and ask if he knows her mother. But she decides she must have misheard. When Lorna reaches the cottage, she's relieved to see that Heliana and her crew have left. She rings the doorbell, and Safi lets her in with an air of distraction. Hi, honey, she says, unclipping the lead from Snowy's collar. Safi bends down to kiss his head, then returns to her study. On the screen is a mock-up of a book cover with the name Leon Bronsky in huge red letters across the top, and a sinister-looking china doll on fire underneath. Lorna's read some of his books. They're exceptionally dark. Did you create this? Safi nods. His publishers employed us to do his cover and marketing. Posters, headers for magazine ads, that kind of thing. A rebrand. He's moved into horror. It's a good commission. He's a huge deal. Lorna winces, imagining how much more gruesome this book must be. Did you have to read it? Safi laughs. Yep, it gave me nightmares. She pushes a curl from her face, eyes still trained on the screen and the creepy cover. I'm glad the reporters have finally gone. Me too. One of them cornered me earlier, but don't worry, I didn't say anything. She holds up her carrier bag. Bought groceries for tonight. I couldn't get everything I wanted, but I'll manage to make a paella of sorts. Safi grunts in answer, her brow furrowed as she concentrates on the screen. Lorna decides it's best to leave her to it and puts the shopping away in the kitchen. Afterwards, she wanders into the living room. They were too tired to finish looking through the boxes last night, and Tom had to get up at the crack of dawn for work. Lorna settles down to continue what they started yesterday. She can see a layer of dust on the skirting board and resists the urge to go and find a cloth. She slips off her sandals and curls her feet underneath her on the hardwood floors, trying to decipher if a bunch of papers is important or just receipts, when her mobile rings. It's Alberto. Her stomach drops. She's been trying to ring him for days. He sent her a few cursory texts when she arrived. But every time she called his mobile, it went straight to voicemail.
Mi tesoro, I've missed you,
he says, as soon as she answers.
When you coming home?
I've missed you too. She's not sure if it's true. I'm staying until the weekend, at least.
The apartment is lonely without you.
She doubts that. He's usually at his bar until late. But still, he sounds like he's missing her. Maybe her suspicions about him are wrong. But he doesn't ask after Safi or her mother, she thinks, with a stab of disappointment. I'm needed here right now. Safi's pregnant. She recounts everything that's happened since she's been in Beggar's Nook, but she suspects she's lost him somewhere along the way, because he sounds bored when he replies.
As long as you come back soon, mi amor. Mi muero por verte.
I can't wait to see you too, she lies, ending the call with a heavy heart. She spends the next hour sifting through her mother's papers, hoping to find anything else of interest. Some more photos, maybe. Perhaps of her father. Most of the time, she didn't think much about her dad. But there were occasions when she missed having a father around. She remembers once at school when she was about 10, they'd had to do a general knowledge quiz. Over a full week, they were tasked to see who could come up with the most facts. But the library was in town, and without a car to get there, she could use only the old-fashioned encyclopedia her mother had in the house. Her best friend, Anne, won because her dad took her to the library every night for a week to help her find what she needed. She had felt jealous of Anne then, with her doting father and his mini metro. Lorna had come last in the quiz. Her hand brushes the newspaper article about Sheila that they'd found yesterday. She scans it again, wondering why her mother chose to keep it. Had Sheila been her mum's friend? Had she always hoped to get to the bottom of what had happened to her? It sounds like a straightforward case of drowning to Lorna. And then she notices it, and is surprised they didn't twig yesterday. Alan Hartle, 38, a neighbour of Miss Watts, said, Sheila was a bit of a loner, kept herself to herself, although I got to know her quite well. Alan Hartle. Wasn't that the same surname as her mother's lodger, Daphne? Is that why her mum had kept the article? She stands up and rushes out of the room across to Safi's, barging in without knocking. Safi looks up. What now, Mum? I'm already behind, thanks to reporters knocking on my door for most of the morning. Lorna slams the article down on the desk in front of her. Sorry, honey, but look at this, she says, indicating the line. Alan Hartle, same surname as Daphne. Safi turns to her mother, her eyes alight. Oh, we need to investigate it. It could be a link to finding Daphne if they're related. It's 40 years ago. Alan Hartle could be dead now. Lorna mentally rolls her eyes. Typical response from her pessimistic daughter. And if not, he'll be around your gran's age. We need to try. He might be able to tell us about this Daphne. Yes, but... Safi takes a scrunchie from her wrist and ties her hair back with it. I'm not sure what the point would be, Mum. It's doubtful Gran was even living here when the murders happened. I know, but Daphne might be able to shed some light on things. The police are questioning everyone who lived here, and, she swallows, it would be nice to meet someone who knew your Gran, back when she was young. We should leave it to the police, says Safi. They're taking ages. Lorna begins to pace the small room, frustration building. Now she's had the idea, she can't let it go. They have so many people to speak to. Past tenants, old lodgers, and even if they do find and speak to Daphne, they won't tell us much, will they? If Daphne is still alive, it would be fascinating to speak to her, wouldn't it? She knew your gran, lived here with her, with me. It can't hurt. She might know something about this Sheila. She's obviously important, or your gran wouldn't have kept that newspaper clipping. Maybe they were all friends. I've already asked Dad to look into Sheila and the drowning. Oh, right. Did you tell him about the baby? Safi nods. He was surprised, but happy, I hope. That's great. Lorna lingers by Safi's desk until her daughter gives a resigned sigh. Okay, how do we go about this? She asks. Lorna claps her hands together. Right, well, I think maybe you should contact your dad again, if you don't mind. He can get on the electoral roll through his newspaper and find out if there are any Alan Hartles still living in the Broadstairs area. But don't worry about it yet. You're working. Safi hands Lorna back the article. I'll give him a call later. Let me just finish this. Great. Lorna gives Safi a quick hug, then retreats back into the living room. It's not a lot to go on, she thinks, as she continues rifling through the box. But it's all we've got for now. Chapter 18. Safi. I walk into the living room, mobile in hand. Mum is sitting on the sofa, clutching one of the mustard cushions to her chest. She looks up when I enter, her dark eyes sparkling with excitement. And? Did you speak to him? Yep. Dad said he'll try to find out what he can tomorrow. He's not in the newsroom this afternoon. Mum jumps up from the sofa. She goes to the window. Her feet are bare and tanned, and she keeps hopping from one to the other. Her energy is almost visible, like the glow the kids had in the old Readybreck adverts that Mum made me watch once on YouTube. I feel like I need to be doing something more to find Daphne. She touches the chunky necklace at her throat, threading the aqua beads through her fingers for a few moments, then turns to me, her eyes flashing. I'm going to London. What? Why? I'll go and visit your dad. I haven't seen him since your graduation. It would be nice to catch up. That's the weird thing about my divorced parents. They still like each other. They spent the whole time at my graduation drinking and laughing with one another. And when I told Tara they were actually divorced, she'd been shocked. I've often wondered if they'd met later in life, instead of as teenagers. Would they have stayed together? Dad might not be able to find anything on Alan Hartle, I say. The most he'll have is an address, and you can get that over the phone. I know, but it will give me something to do. Get out from under your feet. You've got work to do, and I'm just hanging around here, not being useful. I'll catch the train tomorrow. Would you mind giving me a lift to the station? Before I can answer, she's whipped out her mobile from the back pocket of her jeans. There's a train tomorrow to Paddington at... She peers at the screen more closely. 9:28 a.m. She looks up. Not too early for you? Mum still assumes I haven't progressed from my teenage self, lounging around in bed until noon. It's fine, I say. I think it's a mad idea, but it will get her out of the house for the day and give me some space to finish the book design for my boss, Caitlin. She wasn't happy with my last mock-up. I'm worried I'm losing my touch. I've been too distracted by the move, the baby, Gran, my mum, and, of course, the small matter of the dead bodies. Stop chewing your lip, she says, as she breezes past me. I'll put the kettle on. Mum is already dressed and applying her makeup at the kitchen table when I get up the next morning. Tom was out of the house by 6 a.m. It's a long commute for him every day, and I think the novelty of it is starting to wear off. He was late home last night due to train delays, and fell into bed, exhausted, wrapping his arms around my stomach and conking out more or less straight away. "You look smart," I say, which is true, even if her outfit is something I'd never wear. She has on a fitted black and white tweed jacket with big brass buttons, her favourite skin-tight cerise jeans, and a low-cut white T-shirt with the same chunky necklace as yesterday. I feel underdressed in my baggy dungarees and lemon T-shirt. "Thank you," she beams at me over her compact mirror. Then she puts it down and frowns. "Are you okay? You look a bit peaky." "I'm fine. Just feel queasy in the mornings." Her perfume is giving me a sickly headache. Although, it's not just that. I feel a little uneasy about being in the cottage all day on my own. I'm used to it, usually. And I've been yearning for some time without Mum hanging around. But now she's actually going, and with Tom in London too, it's hit me that I'm actually going to be alone in this eerie cottage with the spectre of the two bodies lingering. I try not to look out of the window as I fetch a glass of water. Tom thinks we might have to hire a different building firm. The sooner that hole has been covered, the better. Every time I look at it, I get the creeps. Mum pushes her chair back. "Sit down, honey. What can I get you, toast? Crackers to nibble on?" I've noticed she's already washed up and put away last night's things. I feel like I'm a guest in her house, which, I suppose, technically I am. She's even fed the dog, something I thought she'd never do. She fetches me some crackers, and I sink into a chair while she fusses around me. I'm too tired to object. Anxiety furs my insides. I feel like I'm the one getting the train to London. What might Dad unearth? This is surely opening a can of worms. "So, what's the plan?" I say, putting down the cracker. It's not helping. "I'm meeting your dad for an early lunch." She checks the slim gold watch on her wrist. "Right, we'd better get going. Now, are you sure you're okay to take me? I'm happy to get a taxi." I stand up. "It's fine, Mum. Come on." She chats all the way to the station. By the time we've arrived, I've got a massive headache. She's still talking as she gets out of the car. "I'll ring you later to keep you updated. I'll get a taxi back, so don't worry about picking me up. I'll..." A car behind me beeps. "Mum, I'm not supposed to have stopped here." "Okay, I'm going. She shuts the passenger door and waves and blows kisses as I pull away. It's peacefully quiet on the drive back to the cottage. I let myself in and decide to call Dad. He picks up on the second ring.
"Hi, sweetheart. I was going to ring you, but thought it might be a bit early."
"It's 9:30. What is it with my parents?" "Just wondering if you've had any luck with Sheila Watts," I ask. From his breathing, it sounds like he's walking. I like the thought of him striding through the streets of London with perhaps a takeaway coffee, his notebook tucked away in his jacket, on his way to a job. My big, handsome dad.
"Well, actually, I did find something."
I stand up straighter. "Oh, yes?"
"In archives, I found a file on her."
I gasp. "Really? What was in the file? Was it the same Sheila?"
"I imagine so. I'm up to my eyes finishing off a big story, so I only flicked through it. It didn't look like much, I'm afraid. I'm surprised it hasn't been shredded. A lot of stuff in archives has just been forgotten about. But it might be useful. I can take some photos of it and ping them over to you."
"That would be great."
"I've got to go. I'm at a job, but I'll email you later."
"Thanks, Dad." I end the call, intrigued to see the file. I need to clear my head before I start work, so I decide to take Snowy for a walk. He circles my legs eagerly while I retrieve his lead and clip it to his collar. Before leaving the house, I peer through the small section of glass in the front door to make sure there are no journalists outside. When I see the coast is clear, I open the door and step onto the driveway. Pulling my jacket on, I head for the narrow lane a few houses down that leads to the woods behind the Skelton Place properties. Mum thinks the woods are creepy and oppressive, but to me, they're beautiful and tranquil. I love the woody aroma of the trees, the damp earth, the bluebells that provide a violet carpet at this time of year, and how the sun sparkles through the leaves. I feel I can properly breathe out here. No pollution, just nature. I trudge deeper into the woods, where the trees are so dense it's hard for any sunlight to get through, and I shiver slightly in my thin jacket. Snowy pulls on his lead as we pick our way over snaking pathways and gnarled tree roots sticking out of the ground like a network of pipes. I'm so engrossed in my own thoughts that I don't hear anyone behind me at first. And then a twig snaps. It's so loud, it makes me jump, and I whip my head around. A man is standing a few feet away. I recognize him as the one outside the house the other day, the one I'm sure followed me to Gran's care home last week. Heat rises to my face, and my mouth goes dry. Snowy stops sniffing the tree trunk to stand next to me, his ears pricked forward. The man has on a waxed jacket and thick boots. He looks like he should be on some posh estate with a hunting rifle in his hand.
"Hi,"
he says, smiling. I nod to him and continue walking.
"Saffron, isn't it?"
I stop. Who is he? Is he a journalist? I turn to him, trying to keep my voice even. "Look, if you're a reporter, I know nothing more about the bodies that were found in my garden. I'm as clueless about all this as you are. It happened way before my time." He holds up his hand.
"I'm not press."
"Oh." I don't know what else to say. I feel the first prickle of unease. The woods are deserted as far as I can tell, and I'm sickeningly aware that I'm alone with this strange man.
"Actually," he says, "the name's Davies. I'm a private detective."
A private detective? Why would a private detective be following me into the woods? Why didn't he just knock at my door?
"I wasn't following you,"
he says, with a little chuckle, as though he's reading my mind.
"I thought it might be a bit too early to come calling, so I decided a walk in the woods was in order. They're so beautiful."
I frown at him. Who hired you?"
"I'm afraid I'm not at liberty to say."
He gazes around the woods as though this is just a casual conversation, one he isn't particularly bothered about. But I can tell by the tension in his body, it's an act.
"Right, well, I know nothing, I'm afraid, so..." I begin to walk off.
"Wait," he calls, even though he doesn't follow me. I stop and turn towards him.
"It's your grandmother I really need to speak to."
"My grandmother? Why?"
It's a personal matter."
"My grandmother is in a care home. She isn't up to speaking to anybody." A shadow passes over his face, making him look less amenable.
"Is she ill?"
"She has dementia."
He rubs his hand over his stubbly chin. Oh, that makes things a lot more difficult. A lot more difficult indeed. You see, my client really needs some information from her.
His tone is colder now, all pretense at friendliness gone.
My heart quickens.
What kind of information?
About something that happened a long time ago.
I see, I say, although I'm completely thrown.
How long ago did your grandmother move out of the cottage?
Years ago. She hasn't lived there in a very long time.
Do you remember what year?
Not exactly, no. I'm not telling him anything. He seems to consider this for a moment.
Snowy starts pulling on the lead impatiently. Look, I add, I really don't know anything. My mom and I didn't even realize Gran had this cottage until she went into the care home. I honestly can't help you.
He moves towards me, reaching inside his jacket.
Can I give you this?
He pulls out a small cream business card. I reach out and take it from him. G.E. Davies, T&D Private Investigators, is typed along the front, and underneath, a mobile number.
My client is looking for something your grandmother has. My client is certain that she's held on to it for a number of years.
I think of the two cardboard boxes full of her stuff and vow to go through them again.
What kind of thing?
He sighs, looking frustrated.
Some kind of file, paperwork.
What is this all about?
I'm just following orders, Saffron.
He lowers his voice, even though there isn't anybody around. And fear ripples through me. I take a step back.
My client says this file is very important. It belongs to my client, and my client wants it back.
Even after all these years?
Yes, especially after all these years. So if you find it, call me. If it gets into the wrong hands, it could cause all sorts of problems for your grandmother. Okay?
In what way?
It's complicated, but it's very important. You do understand that, don't you?
I nod.
Good. Then I hope to hear from you.
He turns away. I stand and watch him negotiating the pathways, stepping over thick roots, until he's rounded the corner, out of sight.
Chapter 19, Theo. Laurinite's house is a red brick Edwardian detached in one of Leeds's affluent suburbs, with two ball-shaped miniature trees and square metal planters at either side of the black-painted front door. Theo manages to find a space outside, under a huge shedding cherry tree, its petals already coating the pavement. It's a beautiful evening. The sun is low in the sky, casting striated ice cream colours across the horizon, and the road is quiet, apart from the tweeting of birds and the far-off sound of children playing. It had been a bit of luck, Theo felt, tracking down Larry. After a lot of ringing round, he'd finally got hold of a clinic he was listed under, and was told, as he'd expected, that he had retired. Just as he was about to hang up, the receptionist revealed the business was now in the capable hands of Larry's son, Hugo. He left a message and Hugo called him back to say he'd speak to his father. Then, just a few hours later, Larry rang him and agreed to meet face to face. So here he is now, on this unfamiliar street in Leeds, on a beautiful Wednesday evening. He's only a few minutes late, but he suspects Larry has been waiting for him, because the door swings open before he's even had a chance to press the bell. An elderly man, who was made up for his receding hairline by growing a white bushy beard, stands on the threshold. He's wearing a cardigan over a shirt that pulls at the belly. He's got kind blue eyes that crinkle at the edges when he smiles, which he does the moment he sees Theo. "Good gracious," he says, "the spitting image of your dad at the same age." Hopefully that's where the similarity ends. Theo laughs to lighten his words. Larry looks surprised but moves back to allow him over the threshold. Theo stands in the large hallway. The walls are adorned with a vast collection of family photos, all in different sizes but somehow complementing each other. He casts his eye over them. Family holidays in exotic locations, wedding photos, windswept children on beaches in welly boots, grandkids snuggled under checked blankets on squashy sofas. Even the family pets are framed. It couldn't be more different from the house he grew up in, where the only photo on the wall is of his dad receiving a golfing award back in 1984. He turns to the old man, to Larry Knight. You can see why the partnership with his dad didn't work out. They are polar opposites. Theo feels a sudden pang for what his childhood could have been like if he'd been brought up in this family, with siblings in wellies building sandcastles on winter beaches, a home full of dogs and cats and guinea pigs and hamsters. A house bursting with love and laughter, not fear and intimidation. A life documented on hallway walls. He wants all this for him and Jen, if they're ever lucky enough to be parents. Then he thinks of how sad Jen looked when he left her this evening. How she'd sat on the sofa with a hot water bottle pressed against her stomach. Her lovely pale green eyes shining with tears she was trying not to shed. Another period. Another chance missed. He hadn't wanted to leave her, but she'd insisted. As long as you bring me back some Maltesers, she'd said good-naturedly, as he kissed her goodbye. You have a lovely home, Theo says now, meaning it. Two aging golden retrievers with grey whiskers come waddling up to him, and he bends to pat them. Larry smiles in response. Come on then, he says, clapping Theo on the back like he's known him for years. Let's go through to the sitting room. Do you want a cup of tea? Marge, he bellows, before Theo's had the time to answer. An older version of the woman cuddled up to Larry in the photos appears in the hallway. She's tall with high cheekbones and shoulder-length white hair and looks smart in a silk blouse and navy trousers. This is Theo, Victor's boy. Hi, Theo, she says, grasping his hand warmly. Good to meet you. Cup of tea? Theo says he'd love one, then follows Larry into a cosy room at the front of the house. He perches on the edge of the sofa while Larry sits in an armchair, one of the retrievers at his feet. The other dog sits beside Theo on the sofa and rests her head on his lap. Larry chuckles. Bonnie likes you. Theo strokes her head. I love dogs. Hopefully one day my wife and I will get one. Well, says Larry, hands on his large stomach. I was surprised to hear from you. I haven't seen Victor in... gosh, years. How is he doing? Okay, thanks. He's retired. How is your mum? I went to their wedding. What must it have been now? 35 years ago? My mum, she died 14 years ago. An accident. Larry's face falls. I'm sorry to hear that. She must have been young. Yeah. Too young, Theo swallows. I know it must seem strange, me asking to meet you, but... He looks across at the kind-faced man, with a large, happy family, and knows he can be honest. I found something at my dad's, and it's raised more questions than answers. Okay. You and my dad had a clinic together, back in the 1970s. Yes, that's right. A private practice. We worked together for years. And I was wondering... He pauses when Marge comes in with two mugs. He takes one from her, careful to keep it away from Bonnie's head, which is still resting on his leg. And you were wondering? Larry prompts when Marge has left the room. Theo concentrates on pulling his thoughts together. I don't know, really. This all started after I found a newspaper article on my dad's desk. He hesitates. Have you heard of a Rose Grey? Larry thinks about it. I don't recognise the name. Saffron Cutler? Larry shakes his head. My dad is so secretive. He never even told me he used to have a business partner. Larry regards Theo patiently over the rim of his mug, waiting for him to get to the point. Why did you and my dad decide to part ways? Larry looks regretful. Yes, that was a bad business. Theo's heart quickens in anticipation, and also dread at what Larry might reveal. Did my dad do something wrong? Well, nobody knows for certain. Of course, Victor always maintained his innocence. But there was a complaint from a young woman. I'm sorry, this won't be easy to hear. Theo braces himself. Whatever it is, he knows he's probably imagined it. A woman complained that Victor was inappropriate with her during an examination. His heart sinks. Out of all the different scenarios he's been envisaging, this one hadn't occurred to him. Don't they have to have nurses in the room with them? This was the 1970s, Larry says, by way of explanation. Did the woman press charges? She went to the police, but it was her word against his. Theo can just imagine how a woman 40 years ago would have found it harder to be listened to be believed. A white, hot anger rises within him at the thought that his dad could be capable of something so awful. He takes a sip of his tea, trying to extinguish it. He can't get emotional about this. Not now. Not yet. Do you remember the woman's name? Larry thinks for a few moments. I can't remember. I want to say Sandra, but I might be wrong. Sadly, she killed herself a year later. The tea curdles in Theo's stomach. Oh God, that's awful. Larry nods gravely. I know. Did you ask my father to leave the clinic after that? I wanted to believe him. But he didn't. Besides, it wasn't just that. There were other things. Theo's always known his dad could be a control freak and a bully, but he believed he was a brilliant doctor. His dad might have been a bit shit at home, but in his job, he helped change people's lives. Were there more complaints? Not of that nature, thankfully. Larry sips his tea. But you said there were other things. Well, we just stopped gelling, I suppose, in the months after the accusation. I think we wanted different things. Your father, as you surely know, is a very ambitious man. I suppose I wanted a quieter life. Theo senses there is more that Larry isn't saying. Did you keep in touch? He nods. A little, over the years. We'd end up at the same conferences. He met Marge a few times, although he never brought your mother to those things. That doesn't surprise Theo. His dad always liked to keep his work and home life separate, apart from the odd occasion his mum had to have some of his colleagues over for dinner. I followed his career. I was pleased to see he was doing well. I really hoped that there had been a misunderstanding between Victor and the young woman. When was the last time you saw him? Larry narrows his eyes. Oh, let me think. It must have been a good 14 to 15 years ago now. Yes, that's right. It was at a conference in the autumn of 2004. That would have been a few months after my mum died. Larry looks troubled. He didn't say, but I didn't speak to him for long. We had a quick conversation, but about work. Bonnie decides she's too hot on the sofa, so jumps down and flops at Theo's feet instead. He leans forwards to put his mug on the coffee table. Can I ask you something? He says. And please, give me your honest answer. Don't worry about my feelings. Of course, says Larry. Do you think my dad was inappropriate with that young woman? Do you think she was telling the truth? Larry's face clouds. Well, that would only be my opinion. No charges were ever brought against your father. You have to understand that. And at the time, I really wanted to believe him. I know, but do you now? Larry is silent for a while. Theo can almost see his brain weighing it up. Eventually, he says, "We'll never know for certain. But my heart tells me that the young woman wasn't making it up. Whatever happened in the clinic that day, the woman really believed your father had acted inappropriately." Theo goes cold. He'd come here for answers, but now he has more questions than ever.
Chapter 20. Rose. January 1980. I was so used to it just being you and me that it felt strange at first, having someone else in the house, sharing our only bathroom, our small kitchen, having to be extra polite about which of the four TV channels to watch. It felt like having a permanent guest, and it was hard to relax. I felt the same about our last lodger, Kay, and those feelings had never gone away. I hoped to get a job when you were old enough to go to school, but until then, the only way I could earn money was by renting out a room in our home. However, unlike Kay, you took to Daphne straight away. She was like an aunt to you, and even though she was quiet with me, she chatted away to you as if she was more comfortable in the presence of children. She sat for hours on the sheepskin rug in the front room with you, playing with your Cindy dolls. She even knitted your favourite doll a jumpsuit in sage green and cream. You loved it. I assumed she might stay in her room more often, but every evening she came and sat with us, handing me a cup of tea, even though she'd only just got home from a shift at the pub. Every week she brought back logs for the fire. She was thoughtful. Daphne had a cash-in-hand job as a cleaner at the Stag and Pheasant, so was out most afternoons, and you went to play school 3 mornings a week. We usually sat down to dinner at the same time. Daphne liked to cook stews in one of my old brown casserole dishes that had been my parents'. Most days there was one bubbling on the stove, and sometimes, if she was feeling extra creative, with dumplings. That was mainly what she ate that winter. Thick, meaty stews. "It's cheap and easy," she said, chopping the carrots so professionally, I wondered if she'd ever worked in a restaurant. She spent ages in the kitchen, in her baggy jumpers with holes at the wrists that I suspect she'd knitted herself, slicing up whatever meat she could get her hands on from the butcher, standing at the counter with one leg bent, like a flamingo. "Oh, I've had so many different jobs over the years," she'd said, when I asked. "What haven't I done?" Even then, at the beginning, when things were good, when I was oblivious to what lay ahead, something about Daphne intrigued me. Apart from that first night, we seemed to have forged an unspoken agreement not to talk about our pasts. But I found myself wanting to know more about her, yet realising if I probed too deeply, she might do the same with me, and that I might reveal things that could put us in danger. What or who was Daphne running from? But in those weeks, those first few weeks in particular, I felt more secure having another grown-up in the house. I felt cared for, and it was a lovely, unusual feeling, something I hadn't felt since Audrey. It was a cold winter. Our leaded windows were opaque with condensation, and there was a fine layer of frost on the internal glass. The stone floor in the kitchen was like stepping on an ice rink. We could even feel it through our socks. But it was cozy in our little cottage, just the three of us, away from outsiders. Safe. A few weeks after Daphne moved in, when you were in bed and we were sitting watching Heart to Heart on TV, she asked if I'd like to go to the pub with her one night.
The most socialising I did was at the odd WI meeting with Melissa, or when I helped out at the local church while you were at play school. And even then I worried about whether it was too much, whether I was being too complacent. Could Joyce and Roy babysit? She suggested. We wouldn't have to be back late. Joyce and Roy were the kind elderly couple who lived next door, a cottage similar to this, but without the thatched roof. They doted on you, and sometimes looked after you when I took part in the church bell ringing twice a month. I trusted them. They weren't gossips, didn't ask too many questions, had one son a bit younger than me, whom they rarely saw, and no grandchildren of their own. They gave you presents at birthdays and Christmas, skipping ropes with hand-painted handles and weeble sets, and when Joyce was in her front garden pruning her roses, she always stopped to say hello, her face lighting up when she saw it was you. I felt bad asking them to look after you, just so that I could go to the pub. But Daphne looked so excited at the prospect, with her gap-toothed smile, her hair messily hanging down over her shoulders. She was the only other woman my age in the village whom I knew. What harm could it do to go out for one evening? To have a few drinks and act like normal women in our 30s instead of two hermits. So I said yes, and when I asked Joyce and Roy the next day, they were delighted to help. They came over the following evening, a Friday, with a tube of Smarties for you, and I said you could stay up a little later to be with them. But my heart still felt heavy as I waved goodbye on the doorstep, you standing between them, Roy in his brown big button cardigan, and Joyce in her floral dress, the light from the hallway spilling out onto the driveway. And then, when Joyce closed the front door, we were plunged into darkness. The air was so cold, our breath fogged in front of us, and frost sparkled on the ground. We clutched onto each other as we negotiated the hill into the village without slipping. Daphne was wearing her velvet patch coat, a black polo neck and flared burgundy cords, a long scarf wrapped around her neck, and I had changed into a long flowered dress and boots under the thick sheepskin coat I'd bought in a charity shop 5 years ago. I tried not to feel jittery, just the two of us in the dark. Tried not to think about being watched from the hedgerows, telling myself nobody would think to look for me in Beggar's Nook. I tried instead to concentrate on Daphne, my lodger, the person who, despite all the promises I'd made to myself after Kay, was becoming a friend. "Are you sure you want to go to the Stag and Pheasant when you work there?" I said. She shrugged. "I don't mind. It's warm, it has alcohol, and it saves us having to drive anywhere." I hated driving, although I did it occasionally, when needed. But just knowing my mum's Morris Marina was parked outside the cottage gave me extra security. I could escape quickly with you, if we ever had to. The pub looked Christmas card pretty from the outside. It still had a string of fairy lights draped around the doorway, and the square stone-mullioned windows were steamed up, but I could see the outline of people jostling inside. We were hit by a cacophony of noise when we entered, and the smell of stale alcohol mixed with peanuts. A group of older men were standing in the corner playing darts, and someone had put "Don't Bring Me Down" by ELO on the jukebox. Joel, the landlord, looked up from behind the bar as we walked in. He smiled kindly at me, like he always did. And I saw his expression darken slightly when he noticed Daphne. I wondered why. My antennae twitched, and I was reminded again that I didn't really know Daphne. I couldn't let my barrier down. It was exhausting, the constant being on alert, like one of those guards at Buckingham Palace. But I'd been doing it for 4 years. Usually, Joel was so good-natured, one of life's jovial types, laughter lines bracketing his mouth when he smiled, which was often. Late 40s, handsome in a rugged, earthy way, with a warm West Country accent
and a love of Aran jumpers. And he had been kind to me in the past. When I first came to the village, pregnant with you and scared of my own shadow, he'd helped me when I mistakenly thought I was being followed, because a man, who turned out to be Mick Bracken from the farm at the edge of Beggar's Nook, was innocently walking his dog behind me on land that I now knew to be his. Joel had sat me down on one of the bar stools, made me a cup of coffee, and waited for me to stop shaking. He never asked any questions, never tried to make me tell him what or who I was so afraid of. He was just a reassuring presence. I often wished he was my type.
"How can I help you, ladies?"
Joel asked from behind the bar.
"What do you want to drink? My treat," said Daphne, reaching into her fringed bag for her purse.
"It's a thank you for letting me lodge with you." I spotted the look that passed between her and Joel, and it gave me an uneasy feeling, as if they knew something that I didn't. I asked for a dry white wine, and Daphne had the same, and we went to sit in the corner by the fire, on the other side of the pub to where the men were playing darts.
"Do you get on with Joel?" I asked, trying to sound casual as I shook off my coat.
He had his back to us, filling a glass with an amber-coloured spirit from a bottle on the wall.
"I suppose. Why?"
"I just felt there was, I don't know, tension between you." She pushed her hair back from her face. She had more makeup on tonight than usual, lots of blue eyeliner. It made her eyes look huge. Was she hoping to pick someone up? I wanted to laugh at the thought. Joel was the only eligible man there. She lowered her voice and leant across the table. I could smell the wine on her breath.
"He made a move, not long after I arrived. He was very insistent, forcing himself on me."
"What?" I spluttered in horror. I had occasionally suspected that Joel might have a soft spot for me, but he'd never acted upon it, and he had never made me feel uncomfortable.
"Yep, I was vacuuming the carpet down here after afternoon closing, and he came up behind me, wrapped his arms around me really tightly so I couldn't get away, and nuzzled my neck, pressed himself against me."
She pulled a face of disgust.
"I could feel," she shuddered, "everything."
"Oh my God." I was an even worse judge of character than I thought. I would never have thought that of Joel. He always seemed like the perfect gentleman.
She sat back in her chair with a self-satisfied grin and folded her arms across her chest.
"I know."
"Well, what did you do?"
"I pushed him away. Told him if he ever tried anything like that again, I'd chop off his cock."
I nearly choked on my wine.
"And he's been making my life difficult ever since. He obviously doesn't like being rebuked. Ugh, honestly, I'm so pissed off with men thinking they can pull this crap on women. Well, not me."
I couldn't help but admire her feisty attitude, so at odds with the nervous, jittery woman I'd witnessed on Christmas Eve. But it cemented everything I thought I knew about her past. She had been a victim of a cruel, misogynist man, like I had. She reached out and took my hand.
"We have to stick together, you and me, Rose. It's a shit world out there. We need to look out for one another."
I glanced over to where Joel was now serving a couple of old blokes at the bar, chuckling at something they said. And my stomach dropped with disappointment. I had been taken in by him, but he was the same as the others. He must have sensed me watching him, because he turned to me, flashing me a warm smile. I didn't smile back.